I wanted to start off by just getting, like, a general idea of what you think consciousness is. So, it doesn't have to be, you know, complete, but whatever it is that you've understood it to be.
My understanding of consciousness, I guess it's just in simple terms, or sort of at one level, you know, what is it? An awareness of self, and an awareness of one's surroundings. I think is probably at a very simple level.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of something like the subjective experience of, you know, sensation. So aside from just data in and response out, what is it that the qualia of consciousness that?
So there's something happening at one level between the sensory stimuli that impinge on us and whatever that causes us to do, which at its very lowest level is just a reflex,
mm-hmm.
that doesn't require any level of consciousness to occur. There are sensory stimuli that come to the brain, and it's the brain, and I think you sort of have to hook the brain and nervous system together with talking about consciousness, because without the brain, I don't think there is any consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And without the cerebral cortex, there's no consciousness, I think. But there's something that happens in between that allows us to relate and attend to sensory stimuli that impinge on us and give us information about our surroundings. It's allows us to relate stimuli to our previous experiences, and because of that allows us to understand the meaning of those sensory stimuli in terms of what significance they have in the world and what significance they may have to our survival, and allows us to come to some understanding about our surroundings through the sensory stimuli that we're being exposed to.
Mm-hmm.
So that sort of happens in between, and then that may be associated with some change in our behavior, some motor response, or no overt behavior at all. What that process is that happens in between our being stimulated and whether there's an overt behavior as a result of it or not, I think is difficult to say. For me, I think it's it has significance in terms of each of the sensory systems that are bringing information to the brain. And I think that's pretty well known from people's understanding of how the brain works and what happens to damage to specific areas, and that we can have sort of consciousness within particular sensory systems, specific to sensory systems. And there's also consciousness of the brain and the individual as a whole. So
Do you think, like, when you say that there is this consciousness as a whole, do you think that sensory stimuli enter the brain, and together the combination of them create this representation to me? Or is there some part of the brain that creates a self or something like it to which the sensory stimuli are the processing or something?
I think there's some higher level of awareness of self and consciousness that is sort of a basis of self-awareness, and the different sensory systems sort of feed into that. But the reason I'm sort of thinking that is that there's some higher level. It's not just the individual sensory systems that produce it is that you can lose sort of awareness and consciousness within specific sensory systems, yet still maintain an overall self-awareness of who you are.
Yeah. In one of the books you recommended, there was some phantom limb cases, but it wasn't like the limb was missing, it was paralyzed, and the person didn't see it as being paralyzed. They've still, like, when they would go to, like, lift a tray, they would see themselves using both hands. They would think they're clapping, even though one arm is paralyzed. So, mm-hmm. you're right that you can be conscious of something that you don't have sensory input for.
Right.
It's not actually true that their arm is moving.
Right.
So they have a conscious feeling of their arm moving, but it's all without true sense.
But this particular question we're talking about now is a pretty complicated one, because you can turn it around the other way, and I think there's evidence for just the opposite, because you can have very specific injuries to parts of the brain and specific sensory systems that really disrupt consciousness in a very major way. So people that have damage to visual areas of the brain, particularly the association areas, not the parts that are important in the recognition of visual stimulus necessarily, but the parts that allow us to interpret visual information and relate it to past experiences,
mm-hmm.
that people that have damage to those parts, even if it's only in the visual area, lose the capacity to understand that they don't have awareness of part of the world. So I think there's sort of an interrelationship between consciousness of the self and whole and consciousness that we have as pieces of that come in by sensory pathways, that are those interactions are important for maintaining our general sense of consciousness and self-awareness. So you don't necessarily need to lose consciousness, self-awareness of self if you have damage to particular sensory systems, but you can disrupt it in a pretty major way just by pretty isolated
mm-hmm.
damage to parts of the brain. So I think there's some interaction there, and it's a, you know, in some sense, consciousness of self may be built up to a pretty significant extent by the different sensory pathways that come in and bring information. So for instance, you know, your awareness of your surroundings could be pretty much disrupted by sort of absurd sensory stimuli in one system. And, you know, I think maybe we've all had a sort of a realization that for some reason we misperceive something, and we sort of kind of gives you a strange sort of perspective for a few seconds about, you know, what's happening. Something's like really weird, yet it's only like in a specific sensory channel that happens.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they're probably pretty closely related, and it may be really hard to say that, you know, there's an overall whole consciousness of the brain and then the specific sensory channels kind of fit into that. I think there's probably much more dependence on our brain interpreting sensory information coming in, and a defect in one of those sensory systems can have a pretty big effect on the whole system.
Yeah. So how do you think something like that would develop? Like, what's more primitive consciousness? I mean, there seems to be a big difference between, like, you know, some apes and us, but if there's a gradual, like, increase in consciousness, what does it start off as?
I think the simplest, well, at the very lowest level, I think there's just a stimulus response and reflexive pathways that before consciousness actually comes into the picture. And at some point in between, started off talking about the sensory stimulus and the motor output, which makes a reflex, someplace at some point in evolution, something was inserted in between that to allow organisms to relate their sensory experiences to real-world experiences. And I think probably a major factor in that has been the capacity to learn, because that has allowed animals to relate, store previous experiences, and allow us to relate those previous experiences to what's happening. And so I think it's probably coincident, the development of consciousness is probably coincident with the capacity to learn and the capacity for the brain to just change as a result of experience. And
so those are physical changings that are happening in between connections that...
Physical, chemical, yeah. Structural, physiological,
yeah.
All of those changes are happening in the brain. And I think as you go up the evolutionary hierarchy, at least here, our brains are probably the highest developed in those terms. And if you look at something, a little bit lower, like late apes, who also obviously have a capacity to learn and things, but we don't really understand, why is our capacity to learn greater than in apes, but apparently it is, because we can do a lot of things that apes and monkeys can't do. And also, along with that, there's our greater development of consciousness in humans compared to apes, although and monkeys, which are closest to us, but that's something that's hard to measure. We don't know what the level of consciousness is in other animals, mm-hmm. but we can assume, I think, this is just an assumption, that our consciousness in humans is developed to a higher degree than it is in other animals. But if you want to make that assumption, it might, it also goes along, I think, with abilities of our brains to learn and the types of behaviors that are part of our behavioral repertoire that we have, which are much more extensive and varied compared to other animals.
Mm-hmm. When we went from the more primitive consciousness to us, it seems like the change that happened to the brain was drastic in its effect, but it doesn't seem like there was enough time for it to have been selected for that way. Is there something different about how the brain works that means that something like that could happen? There is a big difference in the level of consciousness of humans to anything else. I don't know how it could have developed so much so fast.
Seems to be true, although I'm not sure in terms of talking about years. How much was necessary for that to happen? I guess our brains are not so different from those of our closest relatives, apes and monkeys, but maybe the types of changes that were necessary to develop beyond those simpler capabilities in apes and monkeys, maybe it didn't require that much different, but some rather small changes, but significant changes that allowed learning to be a much more complex process in us, or a more effective and efficient process in us, based upon some of the neurochemistry that goes on during learning. Our brains, if you looked at them, are so similar. If you looked at the makeup of the central nervous system, the types of cells, the components of cells.
Mm-hmm.
So, if you're looking at them, it would be hard for somebody to say, these brains look so similar, why are their behavioral repertoires so different?
So do you think that it's the kind of the external environment and learning that has a bigger impact than necessarily the physical structure of the brain?
No, in this case, I think there's definitely something physically different about our brains and our brain function that makes us capable of learning in much more a variety of ways than other animals. So I think there's a real physical difference why that happened. That does require a lot of external enrichment and stimulation to develop to that point. And if you were to take a human and put them in, surroundings where they didn't have much capacity to mm-hmm. learn and interact with their environment, they would not develop any of the complexity of behaviors that a normal human being displays. And so the effect of the environment is very important, but alone I think it isn't sufficient to develop that. I think you have to kind of start with the brain being receptive to those kinds of things and then allow the opportunity for it to interact with the world. And I think that's sort of like the whole basis for how the brain develops its capabilities to do the so many things that it does, because we talked about this a little bit when you asked me the question by email, why have a synapse? And the thing is that there are so many nerve cells and synapses in the brain, you can't program them all genetically. And so how are you going to allow this thing to develop its capabilities? You can't define it genetically. And so the way that the brain has taken on that task is to provide start out with a basic structure which has the capability of changing, and then expose it to the environment. And it's that exposing to the environment that is critical for it to develop to its full extent in terms of what behaviors it can do, mm-hmm. and all of those things. So I think it kind of starts out with the receptiveness to change, but also it won't change unless it's exposed to the type of enriching environment that it depends on.
Yeah, I read that from the point of development, like from birth, the number of neurons in an infant's brain decreases from there, and that it's like there's a pruning process that starts to happen right when they begin to receive sensory stimuli. So like there's kind of this foundation of probably programmable synapses, and then based on what starts to happen, what you begin to perceive, that it cuts and focuses and does things like that somehow.
Right. So and that's really the rule for the nervous system, is that the development is based upon interaction between the animal nervous system and the environment. And that's what the development depends upon.
Mm-hmm.
And without that interaction, behavior is drastically reduced. That's really, I guess, the rule for how so many of the capabilities extend, just like, things like language, that you're born with the capacity for language, but you won't develop language if you live in an environment all by yourself with nobody else around.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, you'll lose that. And so part of the brain is receptive to that, but it has to be developed within the context of your exposure in society to other people and communication with other people.
Yeah, in terms of the evolution of some of these higher level functions, it seems like there are parts that need to develop side by side. So before you could process and use language, you need this area of the brain to develop, and you need a more developed vocal cords, and you need a whole bunch of other stuff to happen. And it seems like it's there's a lot more than one thing that can randomly change to produce this effect. And in between, like, while these changes are happening, the organism won't enjoy any of the benefits if they do happen one by one. So is there something that connects all the parts together so that they can develop at the same time, or is it really just chance that three things developed together and they happen to work together?
Yeah, I think that really normal brain function depends upon that kind of interaction between different areas, and it's the hardest thing to study and the hardest thing to understand, because there to really understand it demands that you be looking at everything that's interacting at the same time, and you know, for us to try to do that, it makes things much more complicated. So typically, the way we study things is to eliminate everything else and just study one area, one thing, one cell, one population of nerve cells that is doing something that we're interested in studying. And so we know most about individual areas of the brain sort of in isolation and try to understand how they function, and then at some higher level we acknowledge the fact that all these different areas are communicating with one another and that real brain function comes out of all of this communication. But that's, I think, way above the level that we usually study and the level that we usually think about. It's sort of like, okay, after you get through studying what you're studying, it's sort of like, okay, well, we know eventually that these areas are going to all interact and that's what results in our normal behavior or something, but that's just taken for granted.
Mm-hmm.
I think, and systems, it's important, and I think we're probably are naive in how we probably think about how the brain works and different sensory systems. I think we often tend to think of things in isolation, but even for the simplest things, I think interaction between sensory systems and sensory motor systems are important in molding our awareness of what we experience. And I think people have done experiments that provide some information about this, and it's sort of like, you know, we tend to think of something like touching something, tactile sensation, you know, it's just all by itself. It's just the sense of touch,
mm-hmm.
and you touch something, and it goes to that area in your brain that analyzes tactile information, and then that's how we experience touch. But for a lot of things, I think, or for several sensory pathways, I think people have shown that you know, our interpretation of that kind of information really depends upon interaction with other parts of the brain, other sensory experience, and your sensation of a specific sensory stimulus can be distorted by effects that occur in other sensory systems or our interpretation of other senses at the same time that we're experiencing that one. So there's a lot of interaction that goes by, and so much of what we experience is in the context of everything else that's happening at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's really cool how it's a very decentralized central nervous system. Like, everything is connected, and it's just really, really interesting how you can have a pretty unified experience.
Mm-hmm.
Out of all of these different things interacting.
Yeah. So kind of, you know, I was just trying to think along those lines. If you were to touch something and kind of describe what it feels like, I think you could show, and probably these experiments have been done, that you could get a different response from somebody if they were actually looking at the object that they're touching.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to not seeing it, but just touching it. And so the visual experience with the tactile stimulation,
yeah,
kind of molds your tactile experience and distorts it to a sense of reality that includes what you expect it to be based upon what you see.
Yeah, yeah. before we get, like, too technical, I wanted to ask you, and you can stop me whenever you feel like you need to do anything else, but, so, do you think more along a materialist point, or dualist?
In terms of consciousness?
Yeah.
I guess I attribute consciousness to a sort of, I was kind of thinking of before when you kind of asked the question or in your email, what consciousness is and how is it produced, it's that it's a property of the nervous system based upon its complexity and its interactive components, but it's some collective property of the nervous system and one that you couldn't necessarily expect to happen just based upon the connection between one nerve cell and another. So it's something else that comes out of the system that if you were just putting neurons together and connecting them, you couldn't have predicted.
So does that mean that...
So it's kind of material in terms of, I think it's the structure of the nervous system that gives rise to it, but it's not something that's easily predicted based upon just connection of one neuron to another.
Uh-huh. I think that's really close to what I think. But this like emergent property of the brain, if you could recreate the connections one to one between like real neurons and then a computer, do you think the computer would gain consciousness? If the same synapses, the same interaction could somehow be replicated, would anything that replicates those connections be conscious?
That's a good question, and I guess it comes down to how you want to define consciousness, because if you define consciousness sort of in simple terms, in terms of allowing something to relate a current experience to maybe its past experiences, if you had something with enough memory, a computer could certainly do that and realize whether it was asked the same question before or how many mm-hmm. times, things like that. So
I think about qualia. So about an experience. I can have a conscious experience of this piece of paper. Could a computer with the same senses, the same interpretive abilities, be conscious of yellow in paper?
Well, it would, but you would have had to tell it what that was ahead of time.
Uh-huh. So if it was perfect duplicate to the point of even having my memory, it could have that experience?
Well, but yeah, sort of, but it wouldn't have come to it sort of on its own, I think. I think someplace, considering, you know, and I could only go on sort of what I know about computers and how they operate now, you know, it's really the instructions that tell the computer how to respond to things. And, you know, if somebody had programmed in something about yellow being a certain way, mm-hmm. then that's what the computer's response would be. I guess what you could do is make the computer's response not a definite thing, like if a computer were to analyze something, detect it was yellow, and then do something or say something as a result of it, that's sort of like the stimulus reflex at its lowest level. Mm-hmm. At a higher level, you could make that sort of probabilistic in terms of what the computer's response might be. And so computer's response to something that it detects as yellow might be sometimes one thing, sometimes another thing. In that case, not entirely predictable, but would have a certain probability of a response. And that sort of maybe moves a little bit closer
yeah.
to consciousness,
yeah.
Like we think of it. But still, it doesn't obviously have the same quality of consciousness that we have.
Okay.
So, you know, it's hard to say that a computer could get to the level that we're at with our present understanding of computers. I think, you know, could someday happen, you know, with great advances in technology, and maybe, you know, maybe even computers would use nerve cells in sort of a actual living system at some point to as opposed to just semiconductor components.
Yeah. There's actually this really cool experiment where they spread a rat's neurons on like a electronic surface. Mm-hmm. Did you hear about this? And they connect like output and input to these nerve cells, and so the thing, whatever it is, it's learned to, whenever it gets like this stimulus from one side, it does something else out the other end. So it can like move towards light now and do all mm-hmm. sorts of stuff, just based on, you know, yeah. zapping it.
So, you know, and even if you model the, you know, some components of the computer and sort of model them on the properties of nerve cells without having even to put in living nerve cells as part of the computer.
Yeah.
It's a question of how well you understand nerve cells. You know, whether that kind of organization, you know, at some point would produce something else that you hadn't expected, like...
Yeah, they're called artificial neural networks, and it's yeah. a programming tool. One thing they use it for is decoding CAPTCHAs, which are like, you know, the thing they make you type in to make sure you're human.
Oh, yeah.
Like the numbers and stuff.
Right.
They use these fake neural networks because they learn. The actual algorithm learns based on, you know, you teach it maybe 2 characters and it can learn the rest.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's yeah. pretty cool that you can use it as a tool within a traditional computer or, you know, the actual thing.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, those are ideas of feature detection and stuff, which we have based upon our, you know, at least in for that kind of thing, the way our visual system detects and analyzes information and then kind of sorts it. And those components of perception you can build into computers. And the question is, I guess, how high a level could you get with that so that could you get something like consciousness out of a machine?
Yeah.
You know, you could say no or you could say yes, and I think at our present level of understanding, you could, either would be acceptable because you don't know what the future holds and what changes and discoveries there will be in the realm of understanding our own consciousness and in technology and what it could do. So, I would say that, you know, at some point you may be able to get a machine with consciousness. That's possible.
Cool. One more question about what you said about the consciousness being a property of the physical brain. So do you think that, basically I'm asking if it's determined, but do you think that you can learn the state of consciousness based on the neural connections, or is it somehow disconnected, even though it's still based on the brain?
You mean whether you could...
Can you, given all the antecedent conditions or whatever about the state of the brain, can you determine the state of consciousness?
I mean, whether somebody's just consciousness is there or not, or what a particular person might be thinking.
Yeah.
What a particular person might be thinking.
Yeah. So can you theoretically find out what someone's decision is going to be on something?
That's a tough question to answer. I think in some respects, yes, and in other respects, no. I think we're just kind of learning now with using functional imaging, like functional MRI, that we're trying to get at, neuroscientists are trying to understand what parts of the brain are involved in our decision-making processes, for example, with things that may horrify us, or we may be fearful of, or things that may be distasteful for us, as opposed to things which may make us happy, which things we may like. There are different parts of the brain which interpret those kinds of situations,
mm-hmm.
sensory stimuli, like looking at faces that are sad or looking at faces that are happy. Our decisions to do things based upon what makes us happy or what may be displeasing for us, different parts of the brain seem to be involved in pleasant versus unhappy things. And so if you knew something about And you know, a lot of this, I think this is a whole kind of emerging field of, I think it's called neuroeconomics, kind of, and how people make decision-making, the whole decision-making process that goes on in people that's related to why we do things in the world, why we buy things, why we like things, why we do certain activities, and a lot of people are interested in that. So I think if you knew something about parts of the brain that were active during a decision-making process, you might be able to predict whether, you know, somebody might be doing something that might be a stimulating, pleasurable activity for them, or, you know, something that was conducive to happiness versus something that would be maybe displeasing or unhappy, make them unhappy, and how they're interpreting things, that situations. So I think you could probably get, might be able to predict things at that level, but in terms of just a person's thoughts, thinking about a particular idea, whether you could somehow reconstruct that based upon activity in their brain, I think that would be pretty hard to do.
Yeah, okay.
So I think you could get, you know, emotionally, where that interpretation's going on, I think you could get a little bit of information about that, maybe about the quality of it rather than what the actual substance of it was. I think it's, I think we could know something about the quality of it without, and not be able to know something about the actual context, but the actual substance of what it was.
Mm-hmm.
So you wouldn't know that a person was thinking about a particular thing that made them happy, what that was, but you might be able to tell that, yes, this thing is making this person happy, and they would make a particular decision because of it.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Yeah, I've asked most of the questions I wanted to. Is there anything about, like, one specific problem about consciousness that you find most interesting? Something that is especially difficult for you to explain, or just something cool?
I guess it's not only one of the things that comes up that I think is just kind of a marvel for me, and, you know, one of the really great mysteries of the brain, and I go over this year after year when I talk to the students about it, when we get to a certain point in trying to think about how the brain controls behavior and things, is how do you go from nerve cells, which are, you know, physical components that have certain defined structure to them. They transmit messages by electrical activity, releasing chemical transmitters, and we understand that pretty well. But how do you go from something like that to a thought or an appreciation, perception of something? As I look around the world, you know, I'm struck by the fact that I know that my retina and the nerve cells in it are analyzing the visual stimuli based upon light, and okay, that sets up certain electrical signals in my retina that are going to be transmitted through my optic nerves to my visual cortex, and, you know, I can understand that well, and there's certain type of activity in there based upon what I'm looking at. But then what happens in the brain? How does all of a sudden that electrical activity allow me to have some, you know, sense, and maybe it's this consciousness thing about that I'm looking at something and being able to appreciate it, you know, and how do you go from nerve cell activity to close my eyes and now I can recreate that scene, where I can think of colors and I can have thoughts and relate things to memory and have emotions. How do you translate, how do you build up those kinds of things from electrical activity?
That, yeah,
mystifies me. I think it's, you know, it's a very simple question, which I think, I don't know whether we'll ever be able to understand.
Yeah. I think that's very cool. And the regional specialization, like, you know, the different parts of the midbrain, and that there are specific areas that do different things, is really, it just kind of confuses me. I mean, they see, you said that they are basically the same thing. They have certain functions and properties, but how does my visual cortex do that while something else can make me move and something else is beating my heart?
Yeah, and there are those areas that have their own specializations to interpret the information that comes to them so well and in a different way from how other information goes to other areas. And so there's lots of specializations that allow each part of the brain to do its thing so well, but still, you know, when it comes down to it, how do you explain that touching some physical device out in the environment is translated to an actual feeling in your brain?
Yeah.
I don't see how you translate electrical activity to that sense of that perception.
Yeah, neither do I, or anyone else. I think that's it. Thanks a lot, really. I really appreciate
all this information that you, or I don't know how many. So how many people have you?
I've gotten one other interview that I did earlier before crazy final time, and I'm gonna ask. I actually leave tomorrow.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I gotta get back and pack. But yeah, as soon as I get back after the summer, I'm just gonna start pestering people again.
Oh yeah. Well, I think people are sort of hesitant to talk about things that they don't have any concrete facts about.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, they probably have some interesting thoughts about the subject.
Yeah. I'm not necessarily looking to, you know, compile facts about this. I'm trying to see how different people think about this, you know, like what makes, because I feel like it's really important for you to get an understanding of it, you know, just for me to be able to function is like, I need to have some idea about what's going on. And so I'm just going to ask all these different people and see what their system is and why.